Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, how are the Olympics at Camp Kinderland very different from team competitions at more traditional summer camps? Camp Kinderland is a very unusual summer camp, which was founded 90 years ago by progressive, secular Jewish activists as a retreat for their children from the tenements of New York City. The camp's motto is, Summer Camp with a Conscience since 1923. The main topics of the curriculum are equality, peace, community, social justice, activism, civil rights, Yiddishkeit, and friendship. Every bunk is named after a hero or heroine of social justice activism, and the campers learn about the writer, singer, or activist that their bunk is named for. Because of its emphasis on progressive social issues, the camp has been accused of being communist by some right-wing journalists in the United States. Katie Halper is a comic, writer, blogger, satirist, and filmmaker based in New York, and members of her family have attended Camp Kinderland for 3 generations. She says that her camp experience has been a great influence on her life and her deep commitment to working for social justice. Among other films, she co-produced Tim Robbins' Embedded, Estella Bravo's Free to Fly, was outreach director for The Take, the Naomi Klein, Avi Lewis documentary about Argentinian workers, and she co-directed Facing Fascism, New Yorkers Remember the Spanish Civil War, a video for the 2007 exhibit at the Museum of the City of New York. Katie spoke with us about her own background and the film Commie Camp about Camp Kinderland.
Thank you very much for speaking with us, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about your own background first?
Sure. So, yeah, my name is Katie Halper, and I'm from the Upper West Side in New York City and a very Jewish neighborhood. And I started out, I actually always thought that I'd be turned into a human rights lawyer or a labor rights lawyer or an immigration lawyer. And I went to college. I went to Wesleyan. I went to this fancy private school called Dalton, which luckily was balanced out by the socialist summer camp that I attended, Kinderland. During college, I actually surprisingly, on kind of a whim and the encouragement of friends who had started a stand-up comedy show at my college, they encouraged me to do some stand-up. And I was like, oh, I don't know how to do that. I'm not funny on command. I just make my friends laugh. But I did it, and I told some stories about my grandmother, actually. And then I really enjoyed that, so I decided maybe to keep doing that. And the other thing that happened is that actually coming full circle back to Kinderland, well, my grandmother had gone to Kinderland, so that's already an interesting link since she was the subject of my original stand-up. But I had met this woman named Estella Bravo who went to Kinderland and is a big filmmaker. Her name is Estella Bravo is her name. This is kind of interesting. Jewish diaspora story. Her name is Estela Bravo, and everyone thinks she's Latin American, but her real name is Esti Siegel, and she married an Argentine man who she met at a World Youth Festival. And she had gone to Kinderland or worked at Kinderland, and there was a trip that we took to Cuba, where she now lives and where she and her husband have lived for the last 40 years. And she encouraged me, because I was interested, had become interested at this point in documentary film, she encouraged me to get an internship at this place called DCTV, Downtown Community Television, which is not to be confused with the Washington, D.C. place. It's just called DCTV for Downtown Community TV, which is this great nonprofit. So I started interning there, and the whole plan of law school kind of got pushed back. And then I became a producer there, and I kept doing comedy. And I worked on I'd started a Spanish Civil War documentary, actually, in college. I finished that. And then I decided to, I guess, pursue the equally non-lucrative fields of comedy and filmmaking, blogging also.
Let's talk a little bit about the movie. At the beginning, you show these right-wing television commentators blasting the left-wing indoctrination that the children get at this camp.
Right.
And then you interview some of the kids who are about to go to the camp. What ages of kids go there?
So the youngest kids are 8, and the oldest kids are 14. And then you become what's known as a counselor in training, a CIT, mm-hmm. at ages 15 and 16. And then you can start being a counselor. So that's the trajectory that I took. But I didn't start at 8, I started at 11. The youngest kids is a group, and they consist of 8 to 10-year-olds. Most of them are 9 and 10, but you have some 8-year-olds also.
Let's talk about the history of the camp. When did this camp start, and who was it for, and who started it?
So the camp was founded in 1923. It was founded by, as the movie discusses, but I'll give it away because it's not a mystery. It was founded by mostly Yiddish-speaking secular Jews living in tenements in New York City who, as the characters explain, wanted a place for themselves and their children, but mostly their children, to get away from the hot summers in New York, which must have been pretty miserable when you were living in tenements and didn't have air conditioning. And also they wanted to make a place that had kind of the socialist, secular, Jewish, Yiddishist values that they wanted to raise their kids in. And originally the camp was, you couldn't get a job there without speaking Yiddish.
Where was the original camp?
The original camp was on Sylvan Lake in Hopewell Junction.
And when did it move to Massachusetts?
It moved to Massachusetts, I have to check the exact date, it's sometime in the 70s.
Do you know why?
Actually, it almost closed down in the 50s during the McCarthy era, but it actually closed down because it got too expensive. It didn't close down. It moved the location because it got too expensive. And that, I don't get into this into the film because of the time limits mm-hmm. of the film, but it actually kept almost shutting down because they would go from one place to another, kind of in a the Wandering Jew motif appears again. They would go from one place to another, and they would lose a bunch of kids 1 year, and then they would try to recruit some more, and then they would move again and lose a bunch of kids. And actually, part of some for the reasons that they couldn't stay in certain places is they faced violence from the locals in some towns.
This was related to the McCarthy?
This was in the after McCarthy, but it was related to the same sentiment. It was, you know, anti-communism, anti-leftism, not that any of the people who, I mean, apparently people actually showed up with shotguns in one case, but not that the people who showed up with shotguns could define communism or socialism, but yes.
Something I found very interesting is that there was a sliding scale, so the more money your parents made, the less time you were allowed to stay in camp.
Right.
A kind of an inverted class system. I don't know how fair that is to the kids.
Well, I guess the fairness it lies in that it's not something that you do today, obviously, but because they don't actually have the financial luxury to do that. I'm not even sure how they were able to do that at any point. But it's, I guess the thinking was that it's, a critic would call it reverse classism, right? But I guess it's also that, in theory, the more miserable you'd be outside of the camp, so the more important camp would be because, you know, I guess in theory your parents would be able to buy you more ice cream or be able to maybe take you away for a weekend somewhere, whereas if your parents didn't make a lot of money, you couldn't do that, so.
Something else that I thought was interesting is that the camp isn't and never was exclusively Jewish. And when
right.
there was so much emphasis on the Yiddish, how did they handle that?
That's interesting. And I could make a whole movie just about that aspect of the camp. But it's really interesting because it's something that started really interesting me as I made the movie. I didn't really think about it beforehand, which sounds ridiculous because the camp is so Jewish, but it really made me kind of become aware and think about my own Jewish identity, which I didn't really actually think of myself as a Jew for a while, up until the biggest part of it was probably actually, ironically, going to Spain. It was leaving New York City when I realized that I was a Jew, if that makes sense. Because
yeah, it does.
When I'm in New York, I'm surrounded by all these Jews, but the Jews that I identify with and I was surrounded by aren't Jews that particularly proclaim their Jewishness. And I'm not religious, and certainly the Jews I kind of most resonated with and identify with and hung out with aren't religiously Jewish. We are Jewish, I would say, but we're not religious. And So when I went to Wesleyan, you know, I was outside of New York, but there are tons of Jews there at Wesleyan, and it's in Connecticut. It's not like Jews aren't heard of there. But it was actually when I went to Spain that I felt like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz when she says, "But I told you I'm not a witch at all," when I ask her if she's a good witch or a bad witch.
Mm-hmm.
Not to compare non-Jews to witches of any sort, but, you know, I felt like, "But I told you I'm not a Christian at all." That made me realize that kind of whether or not I wanted to be, the world was going to see me as, and I'm an agnostic, but I'm, you know, I started to realize that I was seen as a Jew. And I also realized that I really was Jewish in lots of ways. And it's interesting because, God, it's so interesting having this conversation with a Spanish radio station.
You know, we're a Jewish radio station.
Yeah, but you're in Spain, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know you're Jewish. It's called Radio Sephora,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The reason it's interesting about the Spanish part is because the type of Jewishness, when I was in Spain and I would encounter the left, who I would agree with on Franco and I would agree with on Spanish politics and American politics, but I often found people pretty ignorant about Jews. And I'd be like, well, you realize that the most common language spoken among the international brigades was Yiddish, right? Of course, they didn't know what Yiddish was,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't realize that. But that's the kind of, like, the people who fought in the Spanish Civil War, that's the type of Jew that I really identified with, I guess. And the Kinderland has a plaque, like has a wall, with the names of people who died fighting in Spanish Civil War and World War II. There's actually a famous within the Spanish Civil War historian circles. There's a famous handkerchief, like a blood-stained handkerchief from a man who was from Kinderland who died in Spain.
This goes along with the philosophy behind the camp, that it's not a religious camp, but that it promotes Jewish values. And I think a lot of people, especially here, have trouble, as you say, dissociating the religious aspect of being Jewish from everything else. And I think that, you know, what we consider Jewish values are very basic to Jews who are religious and Jews who are not religious. I mean, there's something there that kind of unites people. And I noticed that in the welcome meeting, they told the campers that the camp is known for socially progressive values.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about the themes?
Sure, yeah. So the camp, I mean, I didn't really say this, I meant to say this, but it's part of its Jewishness is, some people see it as ironic. I don't really see it as ironic. I see it as complex. The Jewish values are based in universalism. So for me and for the camp, the very way that you're Jewish is by not being exclusively Jewish, which relates back to your question about, you know, how it was never exclusively Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not just a coincidence. You know, I think it's part of the very nature of its Jewishness, which gets a little complicated. And one of the characters brings up the fact that, you know, you say you're a Jewish camp and you're interracial, how can you do both things? And it's kind of a negotiation, but it's actually the way that we're expressing our Jewish identity is by not being exclusively Jewish.
Yeah, I think that's something that we can understand, but that's very hard to explain to other people.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What kind of activities do they do at this camp? And are any of them interage activities?
Yeah, I mean, they're interage in that, first of all, during the Olympics, which the movie features, we have that. So usually you're with your group age, but during the Olympics, you have the kids of different age groups all working together. They're on teams. You're no longer just with your group. And then you have choice. It's funny. Of course, we have some activity called choice every day, and that's also mixed age. So there's a lot of intergenerational bonding. And then, of course, you have the CITs, the counselors in training, who are kind of working with kids of all ages.
Can you explain about the Olympics? Because that's kind of related to the themes, and it seems that every summer there's a different theme.
Right, exactly. So every summer there's a theme. There's a theme of the summer, and this year, the year that I was filming, the theme was From Discussion to Action, Making the World a Better Place. And the teams were Greenpeace, Center for Constitutional Rights, Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, and the Highlander Center.
And so how does this work with the teams? What do they do?
So each team learns about its organization. And what's cool is that every other camp, well, lots of other camps have something called the Color Wars. And that's when the whole camp is divided up into teams, just named after colors. and they just play sports. And some kids who have gone to other camps talk about how competitive they are and how all you do is learn how to kill each other, basically, in sports. But at Kinderland, we don't have that. We have a sports aspect, but we also have a culture aspect and also learning. So you learn about your team, and then you make up dances, and you make up songs, and you make up skits, and you make up art related to your theme. So the sports are just kind of part of it.
And there is some kind of a contest, right, between
the... Yeah, that's an interesting part. That's like, we used, actually, the camp used to not score anything, and everything would end in what was known as a Kinderland tie. And then they had a very, very serious pedagogical discussion about this, where they decided that it was important for the kids to learn to deal with winning and losing, because they were going to do that in life. So the goal then became to kind of learn how to make sports fun without obsessing over who won or lost, without kind of sugarcoating the fact that there's winners and losers in the real world of sports, at least. They don't believe, it's funny, they don't apply that to social justice. They don't believe that winners and losers that come out in the real world should be replicated at camp, obviously. But there's a funny thing where there's a big debate over it, apparently, about whether or not to continue scoring. And Ira Polanski, the programming director now and used to be a sports director, says, you know, it's ridiculous because everyone will keep score anyway.
Something I thought was interesting is that it seems that the kids are almost ahead of the administration, in the sense that the movie said that the kids are shoving the camp in the direction of environmental action even more.
Yeah, so the camp has kind of an old school, you know, I think it's not, sadly, it's not that surprising. It has kind of an old school, associates the environment with kind of professional activism, kind of, you know, like, or popular or trendy activism. And I think the environmental movement has improved a lot. But I think before and for a long time, it really was seen and presented itself as a kind of bougie movement. You know, people who cared about the environment didn't necessarily care about people.
Mm-hmm.
Point is that the environmental movement, I think, has been slow to pick up, like, the old left, because both the old left was being myopic about the environment and not realizing what a social justice issue it is and what a racial and economic issue it is. And because the environmental movement, I think, didn't do a good job of communicating that. I think things have changed now, and younger kids are more in tune with that also.
Mm-hmm. Something I wanted to go back to about Yiddish. Something that was said in the film is that the preservation of Yiddish is an act of defiance and survival.
Right.
And it's the language is taught along with history and culture. How is that done? How is that received by... I imagine most of the kids don't have any contact with Yiddish at all outside of the
right.
camp.
Some of them go to a shul, which Maddie talks about, the character. But no, yeah, most of them don't. So Yiddish at camp, again, it used to be mandatory, but it's really become like a flavoring kind of at the camp. So they learn abyssal, as we like to say, abyssal of Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
And they just learn about what it is and the importance of it. I mean, I don't know what the solution is. Actually, there's a huge, huge, huge controversy because there's a Yiddish symbol in our logo that was removed because they didn't want to alienate non-Jews. They wanted to, you know, not look like an exclusively Jewish organization. I don't know how good of a move that was, honestly. It's really interesting the way, while making the film, I feel like I forged new relationships with people I already knew
mm-hmm.
and also kind of understood things in a different way. I mean, some of it's with age, obviously, also. But it was kind of like when you go to camp, you don't realize how special it is because you're going to this camp, and then you move away and you go on with your life and you realize how unique it is. I always realized it was special because my friends from there were my closest friends.
Well, and then people from the camp participate in social activity, not social, but...
Social justice.
Yeah, social justice activities during the year because there
right.
was a scene of people participating in Occupy Wall Street, for example.
Right. So, yeah, that was something I really wanted to show. There are two ways that Kinderland kind of exists outside of Kinderland. One is that it does, like, in a literal way. So you're a counselor in training, but you go to the Hiroshima commemoration in Winston, Connecticut. So what happens is the counselors in training all go to that. And that, of course, doubles the population of the people attending the protest. And then also we have something called UNCOR, which is United Council on Resistance. United Council of Artists, which is a kind of activist group that meets during the year. So those are the very literal ways that Kinderland meets, like participates in activism outside of the camp. But it also really does do that, too, in how it influences people's futures and careers. Like, I always say that I'm not the best example because Kinderland certainly reinforced what I learned and made it cool. But I was already learning this stuff from my parents. And for me, it wasn't as dramatic as it is for other people I know who, like, I have a friend named Cora who's a few years older than me who says that she would never have been a teacher if it hadn't been for Kinderland. You know, she teaches in a public school. She's a math teacher. Or she never would have been, you know, Walter, one of the characters, and it becomes a social worker because of Kinderland.
And yeah, but the kids who go to Kinderland go there because their parents send them there, so there must be
There's that, obviously, right. So there's that, a little bit of a self-selecting population. But then you get people who go there because their friends go there, let's say.
Oh.
And there are two things. One is that you go there, like in my case, I went there because my parents sent me there, obviously, and I already came from a somewhat activist background. But I think that Kinderland made me identify with it in a way. It kind of added a social vibrancy to it that it doesn't necessarily have if you're just doing one with your parents, right?
Yes.
I think it's important to build, like, social activities and a social life around it. And that's what makes you actually enjoy it.
Just one question, one last question.
Sure.
If any of our listeners want to see the movie, how can they see the movie?
Well, they can go to comicamp.com. I have some film festivals coming up. I'm waiting to hear on some other ones. But hopefully, I'm trying really hard to get it on TV. And I'm working with a producer on that now. And then after that, I'll be selling it.
So if they go to the webpage, they can get all the information about that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
If you would like to know more about Katie Halper and see a trailer of the movie, you can go to the link on this page. Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSepharad.com. I'll leave you now with the song 32 Flavors by American singer-songwriter Annie DeFranco. See you next week.
And you dare to rise up from the ash. A thousand eyes will smolder with jealousy while you are just flying. Love the words that you say. Oh,